It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Gun violence is again consuming the news cycle after the fatal shooting of prominent conservative political activist Charlie Kirk on a college campus in Utah and a high school shooting in Colorado on Wednesday.
In 2025, there have been at least 100 incidents of gunfire on school grounds, resulting in 32 deaths and dozens of injuries. That's according to Everytown for Gun Safety.
When difficult stories like these dominate the headlines, it can cause feelings of sadness, fear, and even hopelessness. Our next guest says one fear can lead to another, which creates a vicious cycle of negative emotions.
So how do we take care of children's mental health in moments like this and find healthy coping strategies for people of all ages?
Travis Wright is a professor of counseling psychology in the School of Education at UW-Madison. Travis, welcome back to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back. I'm glad to be here.
There's graphic video of the fatal shooting of Charlie Kirk all over social media. The images, the commentary can be really upsetting, especially for young people. How can parents and teachers talk about this with kids?
So first, I would say we really need to be very vigilant about limiting children's exposure to media and social media. Right now, the images are re-traumatizing, they're disturbing, and it really makes it hard for children to get regulated and anchored and to feel safe again if they're being sort of overwhelmed by those images. So absolutely, this would be a great time for a social media diet. But then beyond that, I think we really want to first check our own feelings and make sure that we are grounding ourselves and that we are sort of in a place to listen and be responsive to our children's needs. We don't sort of want to inadvertently place our fears on them. Many times adults and kids are concerned about different things, even if we're responding to the same event. So making sure that we're grounded and in a good place is definitely the first part of being ready. And then, you know, once we're ready to have the conversation, I think we just open the space and, you know, ask kids what they're thinking and meet them where they are.
How do you feel about asking your child, what have your friends said about this?
I think that's a great question. You know what, you know, I think we should really try to avoid asking yes or no questions, because the goal is to open up the conversation and create the space for kids to talk. Sometimes kids are trying to figure out what they think, and what is really shaping their opinion is what their friends have said. And so that question, sort of gathering information about what are you hearing, how are other folks around you thinking about this, can be a great way to start the conversation. It helps the kids feel less on the spot. And then maybe the follow-up to that initial question is, so how are you making sense of all of this?
Our older teens may start to question and ask very direct questions like, am I really safe? How am I protected? And those answers require some digging and some vigilance, I would imagine. How do you address this with older teens?
Yeah. So, you know, we are living in a world and in a moment where safety, we can never promise someone that they're going to be safe. You know, this, we live in Mount Horeb, and so our children were in the schools in Mount Horeb when the shooting happened. And so for us, you know, when our kids say, am I safe? We can no longer say we live in a small town in Wisconsin, bad things aren't going to happen here. And so I think that, you know, what's much more important is that kids can trust us as people who are there for them. And so, you know, so I think being direct and honest and saying, you know, we can never guarantee that we're going to be safe every time we get in a car, every time we get on a plane, you know, anytime we leave our house, there is always a risk that something can happen. And so what's really important is that we do everything we can to keep ourselves safe. So we have a plan. These are, you know, this is what we will do if something happens. And I think that older children especially are able to understand that much of the violence that we're experiencing in the world now is actually because of hate and mistrust. And people are afraid. People feel sort of devalued, dehumanized, and that is actually kind of giving rise to, you know, to much of the violence that we're experiencing, sort of this polarization. And so one of the things that we talk about in our family and that I talk with, you know, one of the ways I talk about this with my students is saying, you know, how can we play a role in recasting this culture? How can we help to make sure that people are more That people feel safer, valued, respected. When people feel those things, they're much less likely to participate in violence. And so, the day after the shooting, our kids were not in a place to hear this. They just wanted to feel safe and they wanted to know how they were being protected. But over time, you know, as the fear has become less acute and the kids are more interested in how can I just feel safer in the world, how can I make sure that I don't have to get out of bed every day and view everyone as a potential threat, we have really appreciated the opportunity to talk with them about how do we actually see the best people? How do we become advocates? How do we sort of, you know, recognize when people might be suffering and help them sort of feel supported? And I think that, you know, as the kids have sort of experience that change in themselves, as they feel like they have more control over how they engage other people, that's actually helped them start to have more faith in themselves and others. They feel less powerless. They feel like there's something they can do. And I think, you know, longer term, that really is how we kind of change the culture that is giving rise to a lot of this violence. You know, when our response is to become angry or to feel more under attack or to view ourselves as being more under threat, you know, when we talk about retribution and revenge, that actually just keeps us in a place of fear, and that actually increases the likelihood that these events will happen again.
Travis Wright is with us, professor of counseling psychology in the School of Education at UW-Madison, as we talk about how to take care when difficult news is circulating, like this week's gun violence. Travis, trauma results from emotionally painful or abusive experiences. Can you talk about what trauma is and the different responses to it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think when we think about trauma, there are sort of two types of responses. There's the physiological response and the psychological response. And the two criteria for something to actually be trauma is that it leads us to feel helpless or hopeless, and it overwhelms our capacity to cope. And so if we wonder if we are going to survive this or if we want to survive this, that actually creates these sort of physiological responses in our body that are hardwired. And those responses are fighting, fleeing, or freezing. So we, you know, fight back, we run away, we shut down. And so if you are watching your child or you're noticing yourself, you're having reactions that sort of can be understood through those lenses. You know, are you irritable? Are you sort of flicking off? Are you sort of running away or avoiding things? Are you procrastinating? Are you zoning out and daydreaming? Those responses are real clues that you are traumatized. And when you're traumatized, your body has some hardwired ways to respond. You feel hypervigilant. You're more distracted. You have a harder time sleeping. You're more likely to engage in conflict. And so the way that we sort of respond to those physiological shifts is to try to re-regulate that stress response system. So we have to soothe ourselves. We have to be really mindful about kind of de-escalating. So those deep breaths, exercise, sleep, meditation, anything that we can use to calm our nervous system really helps us return back to that baseline where we're viewing the world as a safe place and we're not feeling constantly under threat. Yeah. But psychologically, those wounds can last much longer. So when we, you know, are scared for our lives, we start to view ourselves as vulnerable. We tend to view other people as threats. We may feel less hopeful, less optimistic about the world or our future. And those things can lead to longer term consequences like depression or shame or guilt or low self-esteem. And those are the things that we really, you know, long after the exposure to the initial event, those consequences can continue to impact our lives.
I want to return to what you said about, you know, just the taking care with the regular exercise and sleep and food. How do established routines help kids feel more secure? And what's the connection there?
Well, you know, trauma by definition is when something out of our control and unpredictable makes us feel like our life is threatened. And so a really good antidote to that is introducing a lot of certainty and clarity around expectations. So especially for younger children, but for all of us, regardless of our age, having a clear routine can be a really wonderful way to feel more sure and certain. When one has experienced trauma, anything that's unexpected feels threatening. And so if we can maintain consistent routines and schedules and very clear, consistent expectations, that minimizes the likelihood that kids or any of us are going to have to experience something that catches us off guard. When we are caught off guard and we've been traumatized, we assume the worst, and it can put us right back into the fears that we were initially experiencing.
I want to land here on what could be a bright spot. There was a study from Harvard researchers finding that the percentage of public schools that screen for mental health issues has risen significantly in the past 9 years. Is that a bright spot for helping young people overcome mental health challenges?
I think it is a wonderful thing that we are taking more seriously the needs and the emotional lives of children. And the other thing I would say is that we cannot be strong, we cannot be resilient without also experiencing risk. And so just like a broken bone, you know, where the bone heals, it's actually stronger. The bone that forms in the break is actually stronger than the original bone. And trauma is just the same way. If it doesn't kill us, there's an opportunity there for it to make us stronger. And so the parts of us that have to heal often end up being the parts that we can count on the most when life throws us other curveballs.
Travis, thank you so much for the conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That is Travis Wright, professor of counseling psychology at UW-Madison. He joined us with advice about how to talk with children when gun violence is in the news and what we can do to respond with care during moments of collective trauma.
Coming up, a proposed state law would give adoptees more access to their original birth certificates. We'll hear from an adoptee who's making the case for the change.
It's a piece of our story, piece of our culture, our heritage, our medical, our piece as a citizen here in the state and in this country. So it's very important.
That's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In 1929, Wisconsin passed a law that would impound the original birth certificates of adopted children.
Unless an arrangement is made with the birth parents, adoptees who want to know their biological family history have to find alternative routes to that information if they ever want to know.
But some lawmakers and advocates want to change that, saying the stigma against adoption is significantly less profound than it was in 1929.
And supporters say adoptees should be allowed access to their own birth certificate after they turn 18 if they want it.
In just a bit, we'll meet an adoptee who's been advocating for this bill and hear her personal story.
First, the bill's author joins us. Representative Paul Tittle is a Republican state representative for Wisconsin's 25th Assembly District representing the Manitowoc area. Representative Tittle, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
Can you spell out the basics of what this bill would accomplish?
Well, this bill is a very basic, easy to understand bill. It is basically allows anybody that has been adopted, once they receive or achieve the age of 18, they can actually then get a copy of their original birth certificate. Now, a lot of people don't understand, but the original birth certificate is actually locked up into a vault once you are adopted. Then you're given a new birth certificate with your new name. And the other one is locked up in the state archives. And this would allow people to get a copy of the original birth certificate. It doesn't say you're going to contact your birth parents. It doesn't say anything like that. But what it does is it gives them an idea where they came from.
And we'll hear from somebody who is an advocate for this change. It's affected her life. But from hearing from him and from other people as you've worked on this bill, what does this mean for that adult who had been adopted to have access to this kind of information?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's a lot of other states that have done this now over the past couple of years. For an example, Alabama, Alaska, Colorado, Connecticut, Kansas, Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Oregon, and Rhode Island all have done it. And when New Hampshire did it, it was very interesting. When they changed their adoption laws, 1,760 adoptees requested their birth certificate, and that was from December of 04 to December of 15. And only 13 birth parents filled out forms saying they did not want to be contacted by the child that they gave up for the adoption. Not even 1% of the birth parents are saying, I don't want to meet that child. That means 99% and plus percentage want to actually meet that child that they gave away. And a lot of them have given away. There's some great stories. They were very unselfish. The birth parents were very unselfish in a lot of cases and said, I cannot provide good for my baby, so I'm going to have them adopted into a home that can. And I think that's pretty special.
Now, at the hearing on this bill, there was support, certainly. There was also some opposition. I want to give a listen to some of that. The State Bar of Wisconsin's Children in Law section kind of advocating for that that birth parent, I think, who maybe want to be anonymous. Henry Plum here talking about other options. Here's a listen.
I'd like to dispel the concept that we don't have, there is no way to get the name of the of the birth parent. There is a way. There's a mechanism. Those are...
That's some objectionable saying that, as we heard in that clip. But Representative Tittle, it gets a little complicated here, but there are ways, if the birth parent signs an affidavit or after a birth parent is deceased, there are some existing ways that the adult adoptee in this situation could get this birth certificate. Why do you think that isn't enough?
Well, you know, under current law, you know, adult adoptees are able to get a copy of the original unaltered birth certificate if both birth parents are deceased or both parents have filed a form with the Department of Children and Families granting permission. However, if one of the birth parents refuses to grant permission, DCF will not release that birth certificate as long as that person is living. Now, I'm going to tell you something. A lot of these people have had the chance to that have found their birth parents, have had a chance to reconnect and have just treasured the time to connect back with their birth parents. And it doesn't make their adoptive parents any less of a parent, but what it does is it allows them to find out where they came from. I know my two grandparents from my dad's side of the family came here from Germany in the early 1900s. Can you imagine going through the world and not knowing anyone you're related to?
Another concern raised by the state bar is the existing Wisconsin Safe Haven law. They say expressly guarantees that a parent who relinquishes custody of a newborn shall remain anonymous. I was quoting there from their testimony. Now, that parent who the option is they're maybe abandoning their children or giving it up under the Safe Haven law for adoption, that risk that their anonymity could be violated. Would that be a deterrent to this safer way to give up a child? Hopefully a rare situation, I hope, but it's out there, Representative Tittle. What do you think?
Well, if they really are concerned about that, they can file that waiver to not be contacted at all. And I think that is, again, 99% of them are okay with that. But the 1%, in other words, we should deprive the 99% because of the 1%? I don't think so.
Representative Tittle, I understand you, as I am, are an adoptive parent. The situation is maybe a little different, but is that part of what inspires you to pursue this legislation?
Well, you know, it in part, but I think the biggest inspiration was back meeting with Jack Nassib in 2012. And yes, I adopted my son, and I have an original copy because he was adopted at 8, but I was able to have an original copy of his original birth certificate. Now, it's kind of funny. I have it, but he can't get it right now. And I don't think that's right.
Looking ahead, what is your timeline? What are your hopes for advancing this bill and getting it maybe passed this time around?
I actually think it. I think it's got probably as great a chance as it's ever had. We have some great advocates out there. It's kind of like that snowball rolling down that hill on a real wet, snowy day. It's just gaining speed and momentum and gaining traction. And it's going to get down at the bottom of the hill, and I think it's going to be a nice big snowball.
And we've already had a hearing on this, Representative Tittle. If people are hearing this and want to weigh in one way or another with their perspectives, can they still get involved in this?
Oh, absolutely. We always recommend. And, you know, there's a lot of people that don't understand or don't know who their state representative is or who their state senator is. So I've talked to my staff, and we're going to make it real easy for them. You can call our toll-free number, and we'll look it up for you. You just give us your address, and we'll look it up. We're not gathering addresses and anything for anything. It's just a matter of that. We'll look up your address, and we'll figure out who your representative is. And our toll-free number here at the office is 888-529-0025. That's 888-529-0025. And we'll be glad to connect you with your senator or your representative. And hopefully they can actually be supportive of this as well. And I think it's going to be a grassroots effort that's going to get this done.
Representative Tittle, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Republican State Representative Paul Tittle representing the Manitowoc area. We're talking about a bill that would help adoptees access their original birth certificates, allowing some adoptees to find out more information about their birth families. People like Diana Higginbottom Anagnostopoulos. She's an advocate and proud adoptee. She testified in favor of this bill earlier this month and was part of past efforts to enact similar legislation. She joins us now to tell us more about her story. Diana, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Diana, you've shared your story publicly in testimony for this bill and elsewhere. Can you share, though, with us now your story of adoption and then your search for your birth parents?
Yes, I can. I am an adoptee from 1970, where the times were a little bit different. We handled adoptions differently than we would in 2025. At that time, my birth mother never disclosed who my father was, even though in my adoption papers, it clearly says she names him. She had many details about him, but she kept the secret. She still keeps his secret. I've tried since the time I was 18 to get information or get answers to questions, but they would only allow me basic information or non-identifying information. So if once you fast forward to 2019, after the years long and decades long battle, DNA helped me discover who my father actually was. But by the time I could get to him, he had already passed. So he passed away just a few years before I got to him without knowing that he gave life to me. Instead, I discovered that I had a big Greek family. I had siblings. His widow welcomed me into the family, and she has since legally adopted me back into the family that I was supposed to be in. And her first words to me were, if your dad would have known you existed, he would have raised you and I would have helped him. So that was always the driving force, was me getting to my father. I believed he deserved to know that he had given life to somebody, and not just somebody, it was me.
Diana, for people who haven't been through this situation, right, people who aren't adopted themselves, they might not get what this means, right, to know that birth family. Can you talk about the emotional importance of this for you and for the people you're advocating for?
The emotional importance would be to know the culture, where you came from. Real important would be your medical information, because they're not even legally required to give us that unless the birth mother agrees to it. You have that. And then the other most important one that is affecting some adoptees today is the real ID. Our ID isn't real when we go to the motor vehicle department. Our ID, our real ID is locked up somewhere. So I have heard firsthand from some adoptees that are actually having a problem getting a real ID. So
all of that. It's a piece of our story, piece of our culture, our heritage, our medical, our piece as a citizen here in the state and in this country. So it's very important.
And what have you heard from other adoptees who are kind of joining you on this journey? What kind of stories are you hearing?
It's mirrored. We all have the same language. Some of the adoption stories are different, the way that they were adopted and the way that they were raised, but every one of them is dealing with the same disadvantages.
Now, again, there were some testimony opposed to these changes from the State Bar of Wisconsin's Children and Law section. I want to give a listen out to Bridget Kinderman saying concerns that this bill would apply retroactively. Here's a listen.
There was great stories here today, like great stories and that people shared, and like those are heartwarming. But there is the other hand, the people who are not here to say, I don't want this to happen. I don't want my information to go out there. We're here to speak that. And the retroactive piece of it is the concerning piece, because a commitment was made to them that their information would be private and remain private.
So looking back, that parent who made maybe a painful decision and wanted to make a clean break and be completely anonymous, well, the rules would retroactively change on them. What do you say to those concerns?
That's a really great question. First, we have a triad in adoption: the adopted child, the birth parent, and then the adoptive parent. They were all represented that day. However, the Wisconsin Bar, both Mr. Plum and Bridget, arrived late, so they did not even hear that testimony. So I'm not sure how they were even commenting on it, because they even did say that there was only one side represented. But that wasn't true. All of them were represented that day. Then my other part is, yes, they did make a promise. The attorneys, the adoptive law attorneys, when doing the TPR, it probably was a selling point.
Termination of parental rights, right?
Right. It was probably a selling point. Like, hey, we guarantee your anonymity. And mind you, these birth mothers that were giving up their child probably were afraid, had an abundance of emotions to do this, probably wanted it over, you know, the guilt, the shame, all of it. But it's also a promise or a contract that the adoptee didn't willfully enter into. Maybe as a child, we were forced, but that's where I believe that adult age of 18, we should no longer be held to that promise or that binding agreement. We had no part in it. So we didn't agree to that. So you're holding us accountable and hindering our identity based on some negotiation or promise that they made to the birth mother, not us. We weren't included in that.
Now, stepping away from the bill in particular for a moment, Diana, it seems, at least my experience as an adoptive parent and hearing from others, it seems like the stigma around adoption has changed a lot. The idea that, oh, it's this shocking family secret that you see in the soap operas. Do you see more openness about adoption maybe since 1970 when you were adopted? And maybe that openness might lead to fewer situations like yours?
Absolutely. 2025 is completely different from 1970. In fact, I speak to some of the state funded programs or granted programs about adoption for parents who are about to adopt or foster parents who are going to permanently adopt a child. And I'm an adoptee and I adopted a child. That is a true story. So I have a daughter that I adopted. So it is, and I make sure that my daughter knows everything. She even has a relationship with her biological mom, because I'm not insecure and I know it's about her well-being, not mine. It's about my daughter building healthy relationships, not my insecurities or my ego. It has nothing to do with that. It is 100% about the adopted child.
Well, I want to turn it around and make it about you for our last couple of minutes, Diana. Can you talk about, you mentioned your Greek family now. Can mm-hmm. you talk about your relationship with them now and what that's meant to you?
It means everything. It has completely changed my life.
I understand now how, you know, the childhood feelings were valid, the teenage years were valid, because I was adopted into a home where the two parents were divorced by the time I was two. And it wasn't such a pretty childhood, without going into too much detail. So to now find the big Greek family, I found people that love like I do. I was taught my culture, taught where I came from. Just it affected me and changed my life so much that I uprooted, bought a home near them. We all talk, this big Greek family. We're in contact every day. You know, we're very close. They have welcomed me. Just life changing. Now, I don't have a relationship with my birth mother and her side, but I completely accept that. That is her decision that she doesn't want to meet and keep me a secret. So I have no choice but to respect that. So I'm grateful for the other side that I have. They fill me up with love. And it is even more so the fuel to keep advocating for adoptees, because even though no matter how the story ends, the story is ours. And it's a really big piece of our puzzle that maybe it isn't about those beginnings. It really is a way for us to put closure on something as well.
Diana, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Diana Higginbottom Anagnostopoulos. We talked about a bill that would allow adoptees to access their original birth certificates here in Wisconsin. Diana is an adoptee, testified in favor of this bill. Earlier, we spoke to one of the bill's authors, Paul Tittle, Republican state representative for Wisconsin's 25th Assembly District in the Manitowoc area.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, fall migration is underway for monarch butterflies.
They have this migration that is kind of unbelievable, that something that weighs as much as a paperclip can fly thousands of miles to Mexico.
A check on these pollinators and their environment with a Wisconsin scientist who's studied them for 40 years. That's next on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about family time on Wisconsin waters.
As children grow up, parents find new ways to stay connected with them. Or maybe it's the same as it ever was. Writer Jill Sisson Quinn explores this while enjoying time with her son in the great outdoors.
Along the Waupaca chain of lakes, a system of 22 spring-fed glacial lakes in central Wisconsin, lies Tom Thumb Mini Golf. And the promise of a game is a good way to get my sports-obsessed son on the water. I tried to raise a nature lover like me, but instead I got a 10U baseball all-star. One July day, we head to an unofficial boat launch on the south side of Marl Lake, so named because of its clayish inorganic bottom, which results in gorgeous sea-green waters. We make our way through Marl, Pope, Monoman, and Knight Lakes to Beasley Creek. A short, easy paddle, then pull up our kayaks on the lawn next to Tom Thumb. We golf the 18 holes. I win. My son wins a ball in the Tom Thumb arcade. After ice creams from the snack shack, we dip back into our kayaks for the upstream paddle home. Old school fun for the entire family, reads the website of Tom Thumb, which has been around since 1950. It's a welcome break from the succession of baseball games, which comprise most of our summer. When Beasley Creek opens into Knight Lake, I throw the ball ahead of us. We race toward it in our kayaks to see who can get to it first. My son raises his paddle like a bat, so I pitch to him, and we envision what a kayak baseball game might look like. My son's kayak is a kid's self-bailing craft, meant to be easy to climb back onto if you fall out. He knows this, and it's getting hot, so into the water he goes. He tips over again and again, throwing me his baseball cap to keep safe. Finally cooled off, He paddles toward the exit of night and the pass to Monomen. I follow behind, turning my kayak slightly to avoid a formidable-looking two-pronged log sticking out of the water. Suddenly, the log disappears beneath the surface. The knobby peaks I saw were no log, but the beak and front paw of a snapping turtle. "Look at this huge snapper," I call. My son turns around and paddles over so that we sandwich the turtle with our boats. The shell is easily a foot and a half long, but most impressive is that thick, muddy head, looking like a cross between plant and animal. Unbothered by us, it spreads its long toenails and swims right under my kayak. My son resumes his trip toward Monomen while I snap a few pictures. Soon, he yells with his own excitement, "A painter!" I paddle over. Beneath him, with face and shell markings as orange and yellow as our kayaks, floats a painted turtle angled up toward the sun and down toward the bottom of the pond like its own little planet tilted on just the right axis. It surfaces for air, then dives back down. "Let's call this Turtle Minute," my son says, "because we saw two turtles within a few seconds of each other." Then he races off to Morrow Lake, where he'll jump into the water again, giant snappers and all, for another swim. I smile that this moment holds enough importance to be named by him. Perhaps I have raised a nature lover. It may have only been a minute, but we were present with our turtle brother and sister, my son a triplet, swimming with them in the Earth's many-chambered womb.
Jill Sisson-Quinn is a writer who lives in Scandinavia. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
As fall approaches and leaves start to turn with the cooler nights, many species begin their ancient tradition of heading south for warmer climates.
Here in Wisconsin, at the end of summer, millions of monarch butterflies travel for thousands of miles from southern Canada and the Midwestern and eastern parts of the U.S. to their overwintering grounds in Mexico.
To get an update on fall migration and how these pollinators are coping with climate challenges, we turn to Karen Oberhauser, co-founder of the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project and former director of the UW-Madison Arboretum. She's been researching monarch butterflies for the past 40 years. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kate. It's great to be here today.
Monarch butterflies are in this annual migration cycle. Where are they now in their fall migration?
Well, at this point, they're spread from the northern bounds of their breeding range, which is a little bit north of us. And the ones that left earliest are about to the middle of the country right now. And we can track this migration on great maps put out by a program called Journey North. So I actually just looked at those maps and I see some monarchs are showing up now in roosting sites way down in Kansas and even a little bit further south right now.
I can't imagine how exhausting this journey must be to Mexico. How do they survive it?
They have built up fat stores in their bodies as caterpillars. So it's really important. Their nutrition is caterpillars. And what they eat in their milkweed plants, they use to grow and develop, but they also store fat. They produce fat that they store in their bodies as caterpillars. And then as they're migrating, they're drinking a lot of nectar. So they're actually a little bit heavier when they arrive in the southern part of the United States than they were when they were leaving up here. So they're getting a lot of nutrition along the way. And that's because they need to build up enough fat to keep them alive during the winter time when they can't eat very much. But another thing that they do is they fly really smartly. If you watch a monarch migrating, they spend most of their time soaring instead of using powered flight. So if you think of powered flight as like a bird flapping its wings really hard, and soaring is when they're just moving through the air without flapping their wings, which uses a lot less energy. So these monarchs, as they're migrating south, are taking advantage of air currents and just soaring as much as they can during this flight to save energy.
That is smart. And they nearly hit an all-time low in the 2023-2024 season, and that's according to the World Wildlife Fund data. What has happened to them?
Well, a lot of things are happening to monarchs. It's a lot of, like a lot of other species, they're suffering a lot of inputs that are causing their populations to get smaller. The biggest one for monarchs we know is habitat loss, mostly breeding habitat loss. So there just isn't as much habitat as available to them as there used to be. But they also are impacted by insecticide use, both agricultural insecticides and insecticides that people use in their yards to control insect pest populations. Most insecticides are broad spectrum, which means that they kill everything, not just the target insects. So there's habitat loss, there's pesticide use, and climate is another big factor. Because monarchs are cold-blooded, they're completely dependent on the weather. And if it's too hot and dry, it's not good for their milkweed plants, and the monarchs live shorter lives when it's hot. So the population is lower in a hot, dry summer. But on the other hand, if it's too cold and wet, they do well. So they're kind of like Goldilocks. They like it not too hot and not too cold, but just perfect in the middle.
Well, this summer has had such large amounts of rainfall compared to previous years. The U.S. Drought Monitor shows nearly our entire state is free of any forms of drought conditions. Is that a plus then for the monarchs?
Yes, this summer has been good for them, and it's not just Wisconsin. It's mostly through their entire breeding range. In fact, if you look at a drought map, I'm glad that you looked at one, Kate, you can see that there are very few spots in the whole United States that are under severe drought right now, unlike last year. So monarchs, it was interesting this year, when they first came back to Wisconsin in late May and early June, everybody was saying to me, we're just not seeing any monarchs, we're not seeing any butterflies, we're not seeing any insects at all. But then because we had a relatively benign June with plenty of rain and it didn't get too hot, the drought abated through the whole state, monarch numbers started going up. So we saw a lot more monarchs during the second and third generations in Wisconsin than we did in the first generation in Wisconsin. So that's one of the things we look for in a year, is how much the numbers increase from the beginning to the end of the summer. And this year was great. So I went from people calling me and saying, I'm not seeing any monarchs, to saying I'm seeing lots of monarchs. So that's a great sign.
That is a very good sign. We're talking about monarch butterflies with Karen Oberhauser, co-founder of the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project. That's a citizen science effort to count monarch caterpillars and eggs as part of a larger population tracking project. Karen, why is a close tracking of the monarch population and their migration, why is that so important?
I think from a conservation perspective, it's really important that we keep our finger on the pulse of the monarch population, because that allows us to see what conditions are good for them, what conditions are not so good, what kinds of habitat. Are gardens good for them? Where are monarchs found? Where do they do the best? And under what weather conditions do they do the best? And we can only know that if we're tracking them over many years and over many different kinds of habitat. So it's important from a conservation perspective. And I think almost as importantly, or in some cases even more importantly, tracking monarchs builds connections between people and monarchs. So the people that are tracking them learn more about them, they become more concerned about them, and they do more to preserve their habitat and to teach other people to support monarchs however they can. So it has a lot of benefits, both sort of societal and from a conservation perspective.
How much impact might butterfly gardens or native plantings have on monarch survival?
That's a great question. And because we know that monarch, the decline in monarch numbers is driven by habitat loss, and we also know that monarchs can use very small habitats. It's not like a wolf or something that needs huge areas of land in order to live and survive. But monarchs really can come into somebody's garden that might only have a few flowers and 10 milkweed plants and lay eggs on those milkweed plants, and the eggs can develop up into adult butterflies. So adding as much habitat as we can in any kind of space will benefit monarchs. Of course, the amount of habitat, you know, if you had a choice between a tiny garden and a huge area, it would be better to do the huge area as a monarch habitat, but the tiny garden can still make a difference. And if we have lots and lots of tiny gardens, it can add up to a huge habitat.
You've built your life and research around monarchs. I wonder what makes them so special to you?
I think they're just fascinating organisms. I first started studying them because I was really interested in their reproductive behavior. So I studied monarch sex before I started studying monarch conservation. And then I started going to Mexico and studying them there. And as I got my PhD and became a professor, I had graduate students who worked on many different aspects of monarch biology. So I think what got me started was just they're so fascinating, just every aspect of their biology, from their relationships to their predators and parasites, to the way they use habitat, to the incredible migration that they undertake every year. And I'll have to say it, to their really interesting sex lives. But I think that they just have this fascination. And I think from why other people are drawn to monarchs is their beauty. People really like monarchs because they're so beautiful, even when they're caterpillars. Most people would think they're kind of pretty. They're impressive. They have this migration that is kind of unbelievable, that something that weighs as much as a paperclip can fly thousands of miles to Mexico. So I think that, you know, there are just all of these things, but really what drew me in was the science of them.
Karen, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Karen Oberhauser is the former director of UW-Madison's Arboretum and co-founder of the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project, a citizen science project to track monarch eggs, larvae, and milkweed throughout North America. We've been talking about the monarch butterfly population and the fall migration season that's underway.
As we just heard, citizen scientists play a big role in helping document and track the monarch butterfly population, and we want to know about your involvement with monarchs and other pollinators.
Yes. Have you planted a butterfly garden or native plants in your yard to try to support the monarchs? What do you notice this year about the monarch butterflies and other pollinators? Have you been involved in a citizen science project? Why did you decide to take part, and what did you contribute?
Or did you make the journey to the monarch butterfly overwintering forest near Mexico City? Share what that was like. Send us an email. The address is wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Or you can call and leave us a message or text us about monarchs. The number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson, Avery Lee Rogers, and Royce Podeswa.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter.
Tim Peterson is managing producer. Dean Kinetter is our executive producer. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for listening to WPR News.